On Active Voice Radio today, we get the chance to speak with someone who's been called a gentleman smuggler, as well as a great illustrator of why the war on drugs has failed in America. His new book is Black Tuna Diaries, the true story of America's most notorious marijuana smuggler. We're with Robert Platschorn. Bob, welcome here to Active Voice Radio today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to speak with you, Bob. And you know, just to tell folks, we met each other out at the normal annual conference in San Francisco this year. And you had the book there at the conference. This was following some recording with a documentary crew and then a big article in High Times magazine. Bob, first of all, what's it like, and I have to ask you a little bit about current events, what's it like looking at marijuana last week? I mean, we've got a Department of Justice memo out. It's all over the news. What's it look like now to you?
It's the hardest thing in the world to comprehend, having spent 30 years in jail for a nonviolent marijuana offense. I'll tell you the truth. When I got out to San Francisco, I had no idea what to expect. And I set up our table at the conference at the High Times table and went upstairs to smoke a cigarette out on the little plaza facing Union Square. And I looked out, and I must have seen 30 or 40 people standing in small circles enjoying their medicine and just having a pleasant social talk. And I could smell it in the air, and it just made me paranoid. And I thought, my God, these people aren't cool. Here they are out in the sunshine talking to one another, smoking, and I'd better get away from them in case they get busted. I don't want to be caught anywhere near here. And so I went way over into the far corner, stood by myself for a while. People kept coming over to talk to me. And it took about 2 days to get comfortable with an atmosphere where people could smoke openly.
So this is, you know, this is a new thing. And honestly, it is, even for me, you know, traveling from the East Coast and looking at San Francisco, it certainly isn't the common thing out here to encounter that. You know, Bob, you mentioned...
No, I thought I knew what was going on. And since I'm home, I've been working for an organization in Florida doing volunteer work called PUFM, People United for Medical Marijuana. We're trying to get it on the Florida ballot for next year. And the reception was great. Any place I made an appearance, people came out in thousands and asked to sign the petitions. And I was pretty well pleased with that reaction. But when I got to San Francisco and I saw what was going on in California, it was really hard to comprehend, and very nice.
It's a California is now officially a different planet in my eyes, and hopefully the rest of us will land on the surface of that planet sometime soon.
It's Bob, looking that way, and that's terrific.
Indeed, and in Florida, Florida is one of the many states that's considering active medical marijuana legislation right now. There in Florida, PUFM and other groups are pushing forward for ballot initiatives in the state, and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, as well as Massachusetts, are considering legislation for medical marijuana right now.
New Jersey and Pennsylvania are also home to me. I was born and raised in South Philadelphia on South Street. And I finished high school in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. My family moved there from Philadelphia. So I kind of relate to both places, and I'm very excited about what's going on the ballots there.
When you were young in this area, in Philadelphia, New Jersey, what did people think about pot?
Well, from the hippie days, there wasn't a great deal of negative, at least not on a social level. Politicians would still rail against it, but things were opening up socially. And during the middle 70s, when I had gotten into the marijuana business, it appeared that marijuana was going to be legalized. It felt a lot like it feels now, only it feels better now. 26 states had decriminalized marijuana to a small degree or another, and if you recall, Alaska virtually legalized it, and for about 2 seconds, Texas had made it a misdemeanor, and we thought that we had maybe a year or two in the smuggling business, and then it would be legal, and we'd be in a position to be in the legal marijuana business. But it all went down with Jimmy Carter's change of mind when he decided to reopen the war on marijuana and started just these massive roundups and convictions.
When you first leave this area and you get in first, you know, let me ask, you know, you're this Jersey Philly boy who spent a lot of time down in Atlantic City. You on the back of the book, you've got a quote from the late Billy Mays, the late great Bobby Platshorn is a legendary pitchman and one of the all-time greats. You really cut your teeth out here on the Atlantic City boardwalk as well. What took you down to the big fish down there? Because when you open Black Tuna Diaries, the beginning of the book are these really gripping tales of fishing. And, you know, what brings you from this environment, from being out on the boardwalk to actually going out on the boats?
Well, let me tell you how I got on the boardwalk. I was an aspiring actor in high school. And by the time I got to my last year at high school, I was playing second lead in an off-Broadway play that was at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia, Tennessee Williams' play, Suddenly Last Summer. And we were supposed to go and play Stock that summer and open in Atlantic City, and it never happened. My mom had a small hotel in Atlantic City where all these pitchmen from the boardwalk were living. And I figured if I can be an actor, I could be a pitchman. And it turned out very successful for me. And I spent 17 years as a pitchman, sometimes on TV, working fairs and shows. But anytime I'd get enough money, I'd go do a year of college, and that was University of Miami. I loved the Florida, South Florida, Miami area. Years and careers later, after I had lived in England for a number of years and opened a chain of speed reading schools and built them up, I had 14 schools after 3 years in England, Holland, Germany, had my own teachers in Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, London University. I came back to the States, moved back to South Street, and opened the ice cream factory, which was an ice cream parlor. But really, the main business was ice cream carts. I had the first ice cream carts in the world that could hold dipping ice cream. We sold Breyers ice cream out on the streets of Philadelphia on fresh-baked sugar cones. And that was very successful. After about 2 years, I decided it was a good living, but a hard living, and decided to move back to Florida, go back to school, and do law school, because if I could be a good pitchman and a good businessman, I might make a terrific lawyer. And about 6 months into my going back to school, the pot business was just everywhere in South Florida, especially around Miami. And that's how I started making my living while I was trying to finish school. Long story cut short.
Well, what got you out on the boats though? What got you out fishing? What started to get you out out going after tuna, going after sailfish?
I'd been a fisherman all my life. I had my Uncle Meyer, who owned a grocery store on South Street, used to take me fishing in Brigantine next to Atlantic City. And, of course, we fished for flounders and sea bass, and I just came to love fishing. And when I moved to South Florida, that was just heaven. And like anybody else who fishes, it's a dream to go out and catch sailfish and marlin and giant tuna. And when I started making a little money in the marijuana business, and we had an auto auction in South Florida, in Miami, it started to become successful. And I had the money to do the thing I had always wanted to do, go deep sea fishing every opportunity.
Nice. You know, when you talk about seeing that marijuana business in Florida in the 70s, what did it look like to you from the outside? I mean, you were a student at college. I'm sure a lot of people were smoking pot on campus. But, I mean, the general attitude, this is also, I mean, and you talk about this in the book a few times. This is before the cocaine market was a dominant thing in Miami as well. So marijuana was really a big market. It was ubiquitous, it sounds like.
Yeah, and just before I moved to Miami, I ran into a friend at the Wisconsin State Fair. And he lived in Florida and had been transporting pot for a small-time smuggler. He told me that if I could find a place to sell it, he would let me sell some of these loads he was driving up, these small loads he was driving up to Philly. And so I brokered a load to my partner, Robbie, who I had grown up with on South Street, and he knew some people who could buy 100 pounds or 200 pounds and managed to sell this maybe 1,100 or 1,200-pound load. And then when I moved to Florida, it seemed like an awfully good way to make money. Everybody you ran into was smoking, or everything was coming in through South Florida at that time. It was all coming from Colombia. There wasn't much Mexican or even Jamaican marijuana coming in at that point because Colombian was so much better. And the port of entry was basically Miami. And it didn't take me long before I started selling loads for smugglers who were bringing it in. And that just naturally led to becoming a smuggler one day.
Well, and also, too, you know, in reading these accounts of what you had to do, and it almost seems that on one hand, you're like a dispatcher for FedEx. On the other hand, you're like a movie producer. And on the third hand, you're like an attorney and a private investigator. I mean, you have to find and connect all these people together with this one thing, and at the same time, and keep it off the attention of the authorities, which obviously became increasingly difficult. But I mean, was it all of those talents, the business on South Street, you know, being a pitchman, all that seems to have made you into the perfect personality to do this, Bob?
Well, it seemed to have worked out that way. The 70s were really a very liberal time. And since everybody felt that marijuana was an inch away from becoming legal, we all thought that the federal authorities and even state authorities weren't all that interested. No one involved with us had a criminal record, so we didn't believe we were attracting the attention of authorities. That was really kind of the bottom of our priority list because we just didn't feel that anybody was looking at us. There were so many people smuggling back in those days and dealing in marijuana. It almost seemed like a legal trade in Florida because anyone you met knew somebody who was in the business. And to get into the smuggling business really was a series of accidents. Someone who had brought me something to sell said that his supplier needed a new partner, an outlet. And so I met a smuggler and saw how he did it. Then someone else came to me with a proposition that they knew someone who had a great connection in Colombia and would provide a load of primo pot at a great price. And all we had to do was get up enough money for an airplane, pilots, take care of the distribution, the airfield, and everything else, and we would be a one-third partner, which wasn't terribly equitable, but it put us one step close to being our own supply chain. And when that didn't work out, and this great connection in Colombia never materialized, I realized we had risked everything we had and all of our customers' down payment money, and we didn't have a load of pot. So I got on a Learjet, make a big splash, landed in Colombia, in Barranquilla, and within an hour, I had a Colombian connection, and the rest is history.
We're with Robert Platshorn on his book, The Black Tuna Diaries, The True Story of America's Most Notorious Marijuana Smuggler. Bob, let's talk about the mechanics of what you did here. I mean, you talked about airplanes, there were boats, there, you know, talk about taking a Learjet down to Colombia. This is in the days before 9/11, where flying around in general was pretty a lot easier. But folks may not realize how easy it is for civilian aircraft to go between countries and between airports, and how little authority there really is on these things. So what did it take, Bob? I mean, what did you have to pull together to actually move something from Colombia to Miami?
You needed a good airplane, and our first was the DC-3, which was the greatest airplane ever made, about a 30-passenger airplane that flew for every airline in the world, practically, from World War II to just about the end of the 1950s. Two great big old radial engines, and it sat with the nose high up on the ground and was an old-fashioned tail dragger. I'm a pilot. I learned to fly at Bader Field in Atlantic City when my daughter was born, while my wife was pregnant. And I'm a small airplane pilot, you know, single engine, small twins. But in the end, it was me who had to fly the DC-3 to Colombia because the pilot who was supposed to do it just was reluctant. And, well, the story's in the book. I mean, it's the opening story of the book. But what we used to do, well, this flight actually started from Aruba. So we filed the flight plan to Haiti. And the idea was we'd fly to Colombia, pick up the load, and once we were in the air, we'd cancel the flight plan to Haiti and to just fly on home. When you get near the States back in those days, you just drop down to a couple of hundred feet above the water, which would put you below the radar, and you'd come on home. That was the easiest way to do it. You land at a field where there was no customs, unload into waiting trucks. The airplane would take off and go get put away in a hangar where it lived, and you'd take your trucks and divide it up between your customers. It's a simplification, but that was the basic plan for doing airplanes. Usually you'd file for Haiti, even if you were leaving from the States. And then once you're up in the air, you'd cancel. In the case of our DC-3, because we got captured in Colombia, we never got a chance to cancel the flight plan. And we had a worldwide search going on for the missing DC-3, which really made it hard to come home, but we made it.
How are you now? So here you are. You've been out of the business for a year. You've sort of done the marijuana business. Let me ask first, what made you decide to depart the smuggling trade?
Our plan from the beginning, there were three partners. Robbie, who I grew up with, and a guy who joined us right near the beginning of our smuggling careers, Gene Myers. Gene was able to fill in one large void, which was he knew pilots, he knew where to get airplanes, and he had good transportation. So the three of us became partners, and our goal from the beginning was modest. We wanted to make $1 million each and get out of the business. We weren't foolish enough to think that we could stay in it forever without getting caught. But we thought we could make $1 million, get out, and carry on with the rest of our lives. Robbie had a couple of dress stores in Philadelphia, and then between us we had the auto auction in Miami. We had the yacht club at the Fountain Blue, and $1 million seemed a reasonable amount of capital to build a fortune on. So we got out.
With all that business success, did you ever think that? I mean, you mentioned the atmosphere at the time, and you know, I know that you talk about it, but, you know, was there any point from the moment that you got out that you thought, they might come and get me for this?
No. I had no idea that the prosecutions would be based on conspiracy laws. I really thought you had to be caught, because everything we had brought in was sold, long gone, smoked up, enjoyed, and the last thing in the world we ever thought was that after we retired, we'd be indicted. And maybe the last thing after that we ever thought would be that we'd get the kind of monstrous sentences that we ended up with.
Let's talk about, you know, let's talk about that experience for a minute, Bob. You know, what was it? Tell us about the arrest. Tell us about when you first found out what was happening. You know, what was that experience like there?
The first hint was a grand jury investigation. Our friends began to whisper that they were being called to a grand jury. And this went on for quite a while. And in fact, the first two grand juries failed to indict because there just wasn't any solid evidence. Later, the government brought down two prosecutors from Washington who presented a much stronger sounding case to the grand jury, all of it built on informer testimony and things that, for the most part, we weren't involved in, hadn't done, and never heard of. But then we got word that there was a sealed indictment. Our attorneys went to the U.S. attorney and said, we're prepared to surrender. When are you going to unseal the indictment? They said, oh, we'll call you. You bring your clients in. But, of course, that's not what happened. What happened was 5:30 in the morning, a ram against the front door. The telephone rings. You have 15 seconds to open the door. We want to break it down, and we're going to shoot your dog. I had a big old Great Dane, looked like and acted like Marmaduke. He was probably going to lick him to death, but they were going to shoot him. And that's a very chilling experience. About 40 people ran into the house, all wearing these blue jackets that said federal officer. Some of them said DEA, some said FBI, and then all the rest were dressed in federal officer, whatever that is. And that was the last time I saw freedom for almost 30 years. you want to talk about a shock? We never thought anything like that was going to happen.
When your lawyers told you about the charges you were facing, I mean, how did they expect anything? I mean, did they prepare you for the sentence and all?
Not in the beginning. None of them thought that the charges, as they were drawn up, could even go to trial. They were so massive. It was the first time the government had used RICO charges, racketeering and corrupt influence, which were designed to put away gangsters and union corruption. And the first time they had ever used 848, which is continuing criminal enterprise, or what they now call the Kingpin statute, that had certainly never been used for marijuana and had never been intended to. As I recall, it had only been used once for the French Connection, which we certainly weren't. The lawyers all felt that it could never go to trial under that indictment because the indictment was so faulty. But that was wrong. We went to trial. Then they thought we'd never be convicted of charges like that for marijuana. But that was wrong. We were convicted exclusively on the testimony of informants, most of which was made up. Not all, but probably 90% of what was said in court just weren't things we had done or even been involved in. It was all a shock. I was prepared for my sentence because my co-defendants had all been sentenced. I was the last one. And obviously I was going to get the most. So the 64 they gave me, just it wasn't a shock, but it took me about 2 years in prison in the Supermax in Marion to come down from the shock.
When you talk about a Supermax, you talk about the Supermax prison, and you were in solitary confinement for pretty much 24 hours a day, 7 days a week there.
that was the way the whole prison was. It was on total lockdown. The first 7 or 8 months, we never got out of our cells. They just threw us a brown bag through the bars 3 times a day, cold cereal for breakfast, PB&J for lunch, and usually a bologna sandwich and a cheese sandwich for dinner. And if you took the bologna and the cheese, you put them together, you had one sandwich. That went on for the better part of a year, and then eventually they started taking us to the chow hall one unit at a time. And it was a very dangerous place, not a nice place to be.
Again, no violence associated with any of your operations. The only thing that was really leveled against you was transporting marijuana from point A to point B. None of the ancillary stuff that can be seen in some of these cases out there. Bob, the other thing about it, with 30 years in prison, there's a very human side to the story here with you and your family. I met your son out in San Francisco too. And, I just noticed, for adult sons aren't usually as open and affable and affectionate around their fathers, but you and your son seem to have an extremely special relationship, and one that is just, you seem like a pair of friends rather than father and son. There is a great amicable nature between you.
I've been extraordinarily lucky. Most people who've been in prison more than 5 or 10 years have no family to come home to. Their families rejected them. They have no friends, often maybe for good reason. I came out. My friends were all there for me, helped me get on my feet. My ex-wife had a place to live, and after a few months informed me that we were about to be remarried again. I decided not to protest, and we went out to Reno to get married, remarried. We've been together since she was 15 and I was 16. And my son, well, we spoke almost every chance we got on the phone. We wrote, and we stayed very close, and I can't even believe how fortunate I was. I went away when he was 4 years old and was gone till he was 34. Every chance he got, he visited me. And I kind of tear up when I think about that. I'm very fortunate, because most of the people I met who came out of prison had no one.
He is, and again, seeing you two together is a real testament to that relationship. I rarely see, men with their fathers be so open and affectionate to their dads. You guys have a very special relationship, and that is apparent just looking at you two.
My wife Lynn helped keep it alive, and my friends. As Mac grew up and he needed a man to talk to, I had friends who stayed close with him. My best friend, and he's in the book in several chapters, the guy I worked the fairs in the streets and TV promotions with, Jerry Crowley, Chef Crowley. He helped my son through college. All my old friends gave my son work as a pitchman, and he became a terrific pitchman. And I was able to help him. Although I was locked up all those years, I was able to get him jobs and facilitate the things he needed. Even though I didn't have two nickels to rub together, I had friends, and that helped an awful lot. And I'm just really a fortunate guy. That's hard to take coming from somebody who's been in prison for 30 years, but I don't look back. I am fortunate. I've got tremendous people around me.
We're with Robert Platshorn. His new book, Black Tuna Diaries, The True Story of America's Most Notorious Marijuana Smuggler, available online. We'll have links to it in Active Voice Radio as well. Bob, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us here on Active Voice Radio, and I look forward to seeing you here up in your home stomping ground, Philly, Jersey, here one of these days, too.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I may get up there soon. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Bob.